Wait for it, and we're live. Hey, all you crazy sci-fi and fantasy fans, it's time for your daily dose of shenanigans over here at the Blasters and Blades podcast. Just a couple of nerdy veterans and one chaos coordinator geeking out over our science fiction passions and fantastical fantasies. A place where magic is king, the sky is the limit, and space is the place. We are the podcast that puts the fun in dysfunction. So without further ado, we are going to let our returning guest, the one, the only Mr. William S. Frisbee Jr., introduce himself.
Hey, everyone. My name is William Frisbee. I was born in California, grew up in Germany during the Cold War. But now I'm a, let's see how to go. I went from computer geek to United States Marine Corps Infantry Squad Leader, back to nerd. So right now I'm a writer. I like to write. I'm also a computer consultant. And that's me in a nutshell.
Outstanding. So how did you transition from like being just an all-around nerd? Because I imagine you didn't stop being nerdy just because you were a Marine.
No.
But how did you go?
Go ahead.
You probably just didn't have time to do much with it. But because if your infantry was anything like my infantry experience, the junior NCOs, they work you like a dog.
Yeah. So in the Marine Corps, I grew up in Germany, in Frankfurt, Germany, during the Cold War. So I joined the Marine Corps in 1988 from an Army base in Frankfurt. So I was going to Frankfurt American High School on an Army base as an Army JROTC. So I decided to go Marine Corps, and there was a Marine recruiter there. And long story short, he signed me up and I went off. But before that, in high school and junior high school, even in elementary school, I started playing D&D in like elementary school. And that's, I think, where I wrote my first book, actually. It's a little, I don't know, 8-10 pages of handwritten stuff. And I might still have it in some box somewhere. But I started with D&D. And then, you know how it is in D&D. You like, you know, the warriors. You like the adventure. So then I transitioned pretty easily to the Marine Corps. You know, I was going to go Army, but my mother threatened to disown me. Not that it would have stopped me. But then the Marine Corps recruiter got to me first. I was like, I can see options there. So when I was in the Marine Corps, I went infantry. They, you know how it is. It's merciless. But I was probably the only person in my battalion with a laptop computer. It was a 286, no graphical interfaces, all command line stuff. But it actually let me write. So I could write stuff down and save them on 3.5-inch disks. And I remember at the time it was a 20 megabyte hard drive. Wow. Yeah. You look back at it now. At the time it was like 20 megabytes. I'll never fill this up. You know, I filled it up.
Yeah. And nowadays that wouldn't even hold most operating systems.
Yeah. It wouldn't even hold some of the documents that we create. It's nothing. But back then it was a lot. So that's kind of where I started writing. In the Marine Corps, well, actually before the Marine Corps, but when I was in, I had a laptop, and you know, when we deploy in the Marines, they'd put us on ship. There's a lot of time to sit around on ship. And when the Marines are on ship, the best place they like to keep us is in the rack, you know, in our beds, out of the way. So we spent a lot of time in these very stacked bunks and just staying out of the way. And that's a great time to lay there, think, plot, plan, stuff like that. But then it was great, you know, being in the Marines. You know, I was in Okinawa, I was in South Korea. That was interesting. Desert Storm, Desert Shield. Let's see, where else? Stationed in Hawaii, but we did two deployments to Okinawa. But then part of that, I was on Super Squad, which is a competition squad. They take the best people in the company. And then we compete at the battalion level. If we win at the battalion level, then they take the squad and we compete at the regimental level. And then we went to division level in Okinawa. So we spent a month in Okinawa competing against other squads in the division. So that was a lot of fun experience. The great thing about that, though, is I was never one of those spit and polish Marines, you know, let's shine our boots and stuff. I loved being in the field. I loved, you know, getting dirty and sleeping in the mud and other stupid stuff. And Super Squad was a chance for me to do that and avoid all the, I don't want to use profanity, but other things that infantrymen and military personnel do, like inspections and all that stuff. We got to avoid that doing Marine infantry stuff, you know, shooting and patrolling and stuff like that. So that really influenced me quite a bit, you know, because I was dealing with a lot of great people on that squad. We competed. We came in second place at division. Good times. Then we went back to our regular unit, and shortly after that, I became a team leader. We deployed to Desert Storm. When we got back, I became a squad leader, and it was quite an experience. And then, of course, when I got out, it's like I can't be doing that stuff anymore. But because I knew computer skills, I transitioned over to computers. But I've never given up writing. Always loved it. Always read. My office is just full of books. I've got three walls just covered with books. I've been doing it for a while. And haven't published till lately, but good times.
Absolutely. Yeah, I preferred being in the field to the spit and polish nonsense myself, mm-hmm. just because most of the people that were the best at that were the most useless when it came to actual combat skills.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, great. You look pretty and you run fast, but how do you shoot?
Yeah.
Can you see when people are shooting back at you? That's what I care about.
Huh? You make going through the jungle and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, we trained almost exclusively for desert warfare. So it was a little bit different for us. But like I did 8.5 years in the Army as a guard in reserve. But of that time, because of the war, I was like federalized for 4.5 years of that. So I might as well have done an active duty hitch, because it just was like, hey, you're not done, Sarge. We got more time. We got more stuff for you to do. So almost exclusively, it was going to war or training for going to war or training from coming home from war was my 4 years active duties. I didn't have to do a lot of that dress uniform stuff.
Oh, lucky you.
I know. I hated it when we did it. Although I will say, I do think the Army dress blues looked sharp. And I did like the Class A's, which was the old green uniform we had. They got rid of it, but
figure.
Yeah, that was it was a nice one. I liked it. They went back to the, is it they call it, I think they call it the pinks and greens, the old World War II uniform. But in true military fashion, they spent a couple $1 million testing the efficiency of coming back to that uniform. Like, kind of know it worked. They did it for a couple years, you know. Like, what do you need to test? But that's the government.
Yeah, it's go figure. Yeah, we. The way we would work in the Marine Corps is we did a lot of deployments. We trained for a lot of different things. Jungle warfare, desert warfare, amphibious warfare. We trained with tanks, Amtraks, amphibious or armored personnel carriers, basically. Boat operations, helo assault. I mean, you name it, we got some training on it. So we did a lot of different things. We didn't jump out of airplanes, though. But we did fast roping out of helicopters and stuff like that. And I was part of a SOC battalion, Special Operations Capable, which it sounds pretty cool. It's not like the Raiders these days, but it's a classification that says your battalion can do all these different things. And usually you have to be SOC qualified before you deploy. So they test you on amphibious assault, air assault, you know, mechanized operations and stuff like that before we deploy. So it was pretty good. One of the things, there's always a limit on training money. So if we don't have the money to go to the field because it costs for, you know, the vehicles and the gas and stuff like that, if we didn't have the money, then we stayed in the barracks and we did barracks inspections.
Oh, those are
so cool. Yeah. Oh, it was, I hated that part, you know, room inspections and uniform inspections and, Yeah, I did not care for that in the least. I loved being in the field.
I feel you there. We did a lot of actual work with the Marines when I was in Iraq, because we supported the Sunni Triangle, which was the Marine Theater of Operations. So we were, when we got there in November, we were supporting the Second Battle of Fallujah, bringing supplies to the front lines. It's definitely a different breed of people. I mean, like a grunt is a grunt is a grunt, but how you get stuff done is a little bit different from the Marine Corps to the Army. Yeah. I've heard someone tell me that is where if an Army infantry squad is a scalpel, the Marines are just a hammer because they don't care if they cut it, if they just smash it to pulverize it.
Well, I grew up on an Army base. My mother was Army. She wore combat boots. She was military intelligence. So she was military intelligence on an Army base and an old Nazi base, too. Wow. And it was pretty cool because down they closed off the basement because there were still booby traps down there. And they had problems because there were rats and it was like full of water and just nasty, but they didn't go down there because of the booby traps. But at any rate, I grew up with the Army in my life in Germany for about 7-8 years. And I went to Frankfurt American High School, which is a basically Army Air Force kids go to these schools. And there were several of them there in Germany. So, you know, all my friends, they were Army brats or Air Force brats. So was I. I was in Army JROTC for my 3 years of high school. I had the rank of cadet major when I got out. I was a company commander and, you know, all that fun stuff. So I grew up in high school planning to go Army because I knew all this Army stuff. But then it was just the Marine Corps. Like, oh, now that's different. And yeah, so I got to see the Army. But then when I became a Marine, it was like I could see the difference and that there was a big difference in the mentality. And I have to put this out there. A lot of people have different experiences.
Absolutely.
You know, a lot of people see things differently. But in my experience, the Army was more reserved and more cautious. They like to they had their way of doing things and it wasn't nearly as aggressive. But the Marines, we tended to be super aggressive. And that was a key difference. Just the basic infantry techniques, you know, shooting a rifle is one thing, but the Marine Corps focused on three fire teams. You know, the Army was usually two fire teams, with the exception of the Rangers, which do three fire teams.
Or at least they were. I don't know if doctrine changed got out.
It depends. So, and I've done a lot of study for my book, writing military science fiction, on how that works. And I've pulled up, you know, tables of organizations and equipment and kind of gone through them. So in most cases, in most units, a platoon or a squad has four people on a fire team. And that makes a lot of sense because you have two buddy teams.
Right.
So, you know, you can always pair people up. So four tends to be the standard fire team. Now, in the Army, you have two fire teams, and the team leader in one is a sergeant, and usually the squad leader is like a staff sergeant in a lot of units.
Yep.
And sometimes that varies. In the Rangers are more like the United States Marine Corps, and I find that very interesting because the Rangers focus on aggression. And one problem with aggression, too, is casualties. So you need more people, and it's a light infantry unit. So more people is good because you have more stuff to carry. But as I was saying, the Rangers have 13 people in a fire team, almost exactly like the United States Marine Corps rifle squad. The Marines have 13 in a fire team, which is three fire teams. And usually the way that plays out is as you're moving to contact, you know, like on a patrol, different tactics require different things, but that first fire team makes contact. The second fire team moves up to reinforce and assist, but that third fire team flanks. When you only have two fire teams, you don't have that flexibility. So you've got the choice. One fire team goes up. Good luck holding their attention. The other time, fire team flanks. You know, or that other fire team comes up online and they try, you know, leapfrogging. But those three fire teams, they give you a lot of options because that first fire team is a cohesive unit. It's there. It's made contact. They work together. And then the squad leader has the option of, okay, well, what do I do with this second fire team? Do I reinforce them or do I send them with the flanking maneuver? All right. And sometimes that first fire team is taking casualties. So you might send in that second fire team to help them out. And then that third fire team is maneuvering for a better position, either flanking the enemy or getting into a flanking fire position. So it's all about, you know, how it's deployed. Now, with the two fire team squads, I see that a lot in mechanized units. All right. I want to say M2, and I'm probably going to mess that up, but What was the other? You had the M13, but mostly the M2 Bradley, the infantry fighting vehicles. Yeah. So as I recall, there were like 10 people in a squad. You had the driver, you had the vehicle commander, and maybe a gunner. But then you had the two fire teams, and then sometimes that third or fourth fire team, and I'd have to look at my notes, but it's been a while, would be a heavy weapon. So the heavy weapons would usually have like a medium machine gun, or instead of having saws, they would have a medium machine gun. Because mechanized troops, they don't have to carry that stuff everywhere they go. And if you're infantry, you know, you're not going to carry a 50 cal very far. That's not going to be your standard go-to weapon. You know, that the M60 or the M42 Bravo, that's going to be your next best, but not everybody wants to carry that. And then the saw, when I was in, it was the M249 saw. There was one every fire team, and that was the ideal weapon. But mechanized had the advantage that they weren't so limited by weight. You know, they didn't have to carry everything. So they tended to be a lot heavier with medium machine guns and stuff like that in 203s. And another key difference I saw between the two is in the Marine Corps, the fire team leader has the M203 grenade launcher.
Yeah.
In the Army, another soldier has the M203. It's not usually the team leader. So it's a grenadier. So you've got the team leader with an M16. You've got the grenadier with an M203. You have the saw gunner with either a medium machine gun if they're mech, or a light machine gun if they're light infantry. And then you have an assistant saw gunner who tends to follow around and carries extra ammo.
And an M16 on their own.
Yeah. So it's a lot of variation in that. And special operations teams are organized completely separately. And that's between the SEALs and Army Special Forces. Special Forces are not what everybody, at least they weren't, what everybody imagines going in behind enemy lines and doing raids. They were more training. So my senior Army instructor in JROTC when I was in high school was Army Special Forces, and he was in Vietnam. So, and he was I think it was A team. You've got A teams and B teams. B teams usually support A teams.
If the research we did, and it's been a while, but I think that was like the headquarters element.
Yeah. The B team supports the A teams, and the A teams are the ones that are out there. And I've got an old Special Forces manual that I could pull out to kind of go through that. And then there was a C team, but I think they were usually far, far in the back. But
way above my pay grade, I don't know.
Yeah. But you know, you had within that A team, you had different specialists. You didn't have, you know, a saw gunner, you didn't have your, you know, a team leader, grenadier. They might carry different weapons, but they had different roles. Like, this is a weapon specialist. He is good at teaching weapons. This is the medical or the medic. He teaches people how to do medic. They weren't front lines. They were more commanders and trainers. So this is where I picked up a lot of my information, you know, reading this in the Army, in the Marine Corps and stuff like that. And I tend to put a lot of that in my writing these days. So it's like with Army Special Forces, in the last Marines, there's a group called the Iroquois Chukot. And basically what they are is they're Finnish Special Forces. And they're just like the Green Berets in that they've got their commander, they've got their executive, they all have their different roles and different positions, and you know, they do different things. But they are essentially Green Berets. And then you've got the Jaegers, which are kind of like a cut above the regular infantry. They're elite veterans and stuff like that. And I kind of equate those to Army Rangers. So it's like I take a lot of what I know and I slip it into my writing where I can. And because I was able to see the Army and Marine Corps, you know, side by side for many years, I like to think I've got a pretty good idea of how they interact and, you know, the different roles and stuff like that.
You're missing one crucial factor, though, which I learned the hard way, because the army before the Cold War was different than the Army during the Cold War. All services were a little bit, which was different than the GWAT, which is different than whatever it is now, because I'm out. Mm-hmm. So obviously I'm out of date. But I do think the era you served in culturally makes a huge difference as well, because sometimes the doctrines shift, sometimes not. But I remember it was a big deal when the Commandant of the Marine Corps came out. And he was like, yeah, the war in Iraq and everything, but let's start going back to being soldiers again, or I guess in your case, Marines. But like, he made a big deal about
soldiers.
Yeah, he went made a big deal in a press release about the Marines going back to teaching like basic land nav rifle mark. Well, not teaching, because they always did, but more focusing, making that emphasis.
Yeah, so. And you're right. There is a big difference in the generations. Speaking to some of the newer generation Marines, is we step up in the organization. So you've got your squad of 13 Marines. Usually there's three squads in a platoon, three platoons in a company, plus a weapons platoon. And there's a breakdown there, headquarters platoon. But you've got your company of three rifle platoons, basically, and then other support elements. And then within the battalion, there's three companies. So you see this theme of threes throughout things. Now, at the battalion level, you'll have two additional companies. You'll have a weapons company, and then you'll also have a headquarters company. Now, within the infantry platoon, it's my understanding, and you know, more recent veterans who've been there might be able to confirm or deny this. It's my understanding that during, you know, after 2000 or so, when we were doing a lot of urban combat or a lot of desert combat, they got rid of most of weapons. They took that weapons platoon or took that weapons company, and they either made a completely separate platoon or company out of it, or they folded those troops into the original line companies to fill those out. And that was always a problem is, you know, I say that there's 13 Marines in a squad, four Marines in a fire team, but that assumes that you have a full, 42 people in a platoon, which is never the case. You always take some people. Yeah, you always send some off to mess duty and, you know, other duties and stuff like that. So you never have full strength.
Are you familiar with the balloon theory?
With the what?
The balloon theory of force structure.
No.
Get a little wonky because I studied this in ROTC in college. But basically the idea was that it's a lot easier to train the average Joe E1s than it is obviously to make a qualified sergeant. So the idea is we went light on all the TO&Es, so each unit would be under strength intentionally, because in the event of a mass draft, you could take all of your people, promote them up one or two ranks, and suddenly your draftees are going in, and you've still got seasoned, and you could grow the force that way, which is why you were routinely under strength. So when I was in, it was still, we were training 12-man squads, is what we were taught at basic back in 98, but the understanding is you're never going to be in one of those. Because unless World War III happens, you know, you're pretty much screwed. But circling back to what you said about the team of threes, that made me chuckle a little bit. I was muted because we were talking about that with my squad leader when I was in Iraq. He was a former Marine. He got off embassy duty, thought he was going to come home. So he was like, oh, the guard, that'll keep me out of deploying so I can just relax and enjoy life. And 3 days after he joined us, he got the deployment orders.
So
we got a little bit of the cross training with like how they did things. And that was when we were talking about the different organizations, because we were training up some new people on light infantry tactics, which is ironic since we ended up doing all mounted stuff. But while we were doing that, he was talking about the three teams of threes, and his answer was because of the Holy Trinity and Jesus loved the Marines more. He was very Catholic. So.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I know we were never at full strength. And I've heard the balloon theory, but not called that way. And I kind of understand it, but I also got to call BS on it, because I know when we went to Desert Storm, my battalion was under strength, my platoon was under strength. And then partway through that, they took some of our people and sent them to another battalion, which was even more under strength. So yeah, we went more, but
that was because that war was over so quick. If that had had any staying power, we might have. I mean, but we've never we've shied away from the draft to the point where we called up the inactive ready reserves. People that had been out for a decade under Clinton's early out program but were still cashing that check, suddenly told they've actually got to show up in uniform, which I was with some of those guys. So I get it. Like, in the event – it's doctrinal theory of someone sitting at the Pentagon who is pushing papers and ideas because he knows in all likelihood we'll never get that. Get there again. But if we do, we've got a paper somewhere they can crack out and be like, oh, this is what they said to do in 1974. Let's try it.
Yeah. And I love that in the, you know, it makes you think too, as an NCO, because you know doctrine, you know how doctrine's supposed to work, you know what the book says. And I was really big on this. And, you know, some people would stay, you know, on Friday nights, they'd go out, party, try to get laid and all that stuff. I was one of those weirdos. I tend to stay in the barracks and read manuals. Yeah. D&D geek. Okay. So I read manuals and I tried to learn more about the French Foreign Legion and stuff like that and how they did things, how the Brits did things. They do fire teams completely different, or they did with some units. But a lot of what I learned is that it helps to know what doctrine is so that you can break it. So, you know, okay, well, you know, you have three fire teams. So you put one forward and you've got the other one in reserve and you can send one in flanking. You know, that's good to know, especially when you're dealing with an enemy who does that. But when you don't have that much capability, you have to kind of like plan and think, okay, well, how do I make it work with what I've got? I can send two people to flank, you know, and it just a lot of different things like that. And the book was great. The book was very interesting, but I never, when we went to the field and we started doing stuff, I didn't quite throw it out, but I didn't exactly follow it. So as an example, we were doing ambush routines one night. And one squad would walk down a road, a path, and they knew they were going to get ambushed. So they were alert and they were paying attention. They knew what they were doing. All right. The other squad was supposed to set up the ambush and then we'd rotate out. So we didn't know where they were coming. It was night. It was the jungle. And this was Okinawa. So real quick thing, in Okinawa, there's two types of snakes, venomous and very venomous. You get bit, you know, and then plus the banana spiders were like, huge.
On a scale of zero to camel spider, where do banana spiders fit in?
A little bit under a camel spider. They okay. weren't quite that big, but they were mean and they were wicked and they were aggressive. Okay. I had one Marine flick lit cigarette into the web and the spider ran over and started zapping it with its fangs. And the cigarette, it was getting burned by the cigarette, by the way, but this cigarette was just dripping venom. You know, wow. You want to hear a big, bad, tough Marine scream like a little girl, you let him walk into one of those webs at night. You know, I guarantee it. You know, and plus, you know, it was a leadership challenge, too, getting people to walk point in the jungle because everybody knew there's two types of snakes. And unlike, you know, a lot of other places, the Habu in Okinawa, see, the rattlesnake has to coil up. And the cobra has to coil up. And then when they coil up, they have a strike arc. And I want to say 30% or something like that. The Habu, it's a fat, pudgy little snake. And it can strike in a complete 360. All right. So you come near that and it's just pudgy enough that it can lash out in any direction. We had one chase a patrol once. And it just interesting times. But back to the patrol, we'd been going for days. All right. That's what they like to do. We go to the field. We don't sleep, you know, or we get very little sleep. I knew we were dog tired. And I was the assistant squad leader at the time. And our squad leader had come from marksmanship duty or something like that. So he wasn't up to par, but I was. So I was kind of like running things with him in charge. So I put everybody online facing the road. And that standard procedure, you put everybody online, you put a machine gun so it can cover the long angle, you put out flank security. Makes sense, right? But I knew, mostly because we'd caught the other squad this way, flank security is going to fall asleep. All right. When we did our patrol, we caught their flank security and took them prisoner, and then we just rolled up their line. And that's another story. But back to tactics, what I did is I knew our flank security was going to fall asleep. I knew everybody on that line was just dog tired. And I wanted to make sure that we got this other squad. So what I did is I put them all online close enough so they could wake up each other, or I knew where they were at. And then I went down that road a ways and I sat there on a road waiting, watching, listening for them to come. So then when I heard them coming, I went back and started waking everybody up. And then we were ready for him. And that's just, you're not going to see that in the books. You're not going to see that in the manual. The manual is going to say you put the flank security in place, you know, and then when they walk in, so-and-so initiates it with the claymore or whatever. All right. But you got to take more than that into account. You got to take into account your people. You know, they're going to be tired. You know, they're, you know, even in a spider infested, snake infested, they're not going to be as alert as they could be. And, you know, people like to say, yeah, you shouldn't fall asleep, but the hard reality is, you know, when you drive people that hard, they will fall asleep. And they were driving as hard. And I've never been one to fall asleep, but the ambush worked out very well for us just because we didn't follow the standard doctrine. And same when we were detecting the ambush, usually, you know, detecting the ambush, it's like there's a couple ways of doing it. You have your lead element, you know, 2 to 4 people is your lead fire team. They move ahead of the rest of the patrol or squad to find the ambush. Sounds good. But we weren't playing that game. So it was like me and another Marine. We snuck forward like 100 meters, listening, watching. And then we come back, get the rest of the squad, bring them up. Then we'd go another 100 meters. So you're not going to see this in a lot of, you know, manuals and stuff like that. But it helps to know what the book says so that we knew when we found them, we found their flank security sleeping. So we knew they were flank security, and we knew exactly where the rest of them were at that point. So it was really good to, you know, understand doctrine and all that. And I've never been one to think inside the box. I always like to say, okay, well, this is doctrine. How can we not do that?
That got me in trouble a few times.
Yeah, it would get me in trouble too. But I was very effective as a squad leader.
But as fun as this is, and I would like to keep going just talking tactics and stuff because I enjoy this kind of stuff. We might have to find a way to make this another podcast. But we're going to pause for a moment while we shamelessly show for the man. And when we come back, we are going to talk nonstop about The Last Marines and how your Marine experience influenced, obviously, a series with such a title. But play that footage.
They picked a fight with the wrong species. A nation at war. The United Stars of America. Born in the conflagration of an unprovoked alien attack, the newest entrant to galactic politics took the few crumbs of hypertech gifted to it and ran with them, soon expanding over dozens of star systems and establishing a wide trade network, protected by its powerful navy and the dreaded warp marines. In a fight to the death, a single marine platoon tasked with protecting an embassy on a hostile alien planet, an embassy and the fragile human enclave around it, that soon finds itself surrounded by armed mobs. Can the Marines and a ragtag band of civilian and Navy personnel survive long enough to be rescued?
All right. Thank you for sticking with us through that commercial interlude. So with that out of the way, so we've talked a little bit about your time in the military. You've also mentioned that you wrote before you got into the military. So how do you think your time in the Marine Corps changed the way you tell stories?
I tend to be more direct, more focused, and I've got more experience to draw on. So the Marine Corps really helped me in that regard. So it's like, you know, before the Marines, it was like, well, what's it like to sleep in the jungle at night? You know, what are the sounds? Walking in the dark at night, what's that like? So I got to really learn that in the Marine Corps. And then another great thing about the Marine Corps, especially with our units, is you got to meet other people, see how they think, and understand, you know, a lot of the processes and procedures and stuff like that. So it's just being in the military is a real eye opener. You know, not only in meeting other people and interacting with other people in very high, you know, intense situations, but also just in the general experience, you know, comparing South Korea to Germany, for instance, very different cultures. So you get to see that, and it just really helps you as an individual and a writer expand what you know, what you've seen, and what you've experienced. I don't think there's anything like it unless you're like a world traveler. And in the military, you don't see the tourist traps. You don't see what they want you to see. You know, you're out there, you know, in the woods, in the jungle, and you see the seedy side of things sometimes.
Definitely makes you grateful to be where you came from.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So do you ever draw from people that you knew when you were in the Marine Corps?
I generally, not specifically. So I have to admit, sometimes my memory stinks. And I'm tend to be focused on things more than people. So it's like, I watch people, I watch how they react and watch how they respond, but there are very few people that'll say, okay, yeah, I'm going to take that person. I'm going to put them in my story. Usually it's like their mentality, the way they do things, just the basic rough personality. You know, for instance, gunnery sergeants, you'll have several different gunnery sergeant types. You know, you've got the cold, cool, competent ones. You've got the loud, motivated ones. And then you've got the clerk typist wannabes, you know, and then you've got a whole gamut in between. So just seeing that and seeing what you can have in a unit, you know, for instance, my squad leader, you know, in some of my later years, he had come back from marksman duty. So he was on the range all the time teaching people marksmanship, but he was infantry. He was just coming back after like a year or two. So he didn't know infantry that well. And it was just, you get to know people and teach them and you see how things work. So it's like, yeah, he was the squad leader. I was the assistant squad leader or senior team leader. He was a sergeant. I was a corporal. So it's like, you know, guiding him along, you know, so he doesn't make a fool of himself. So people respect him and know he's in charge, but also so he can be a leader that he needs to be. Because when he went off to like marksmanship school, he was a corporal like me. So he left and now he comes back. He's a sergeant. He's supposed to know all these things. I was fresh from school of infantry or from a squad leader school. So this was just like burned into my brain, you know, but he was just really rusty on a lot of things, you know? So things like that, you know, yeah, it's like, and it helps to see all these things and understand that, yeah, he's a great guy. He was doing something else. So it's not on the front of his mind and he needs to learn, you know? So you'll have that, but then you'll have the gunnery sergeant, you'll have the highly motivated individual, but yet they're totally incompetent too. So it's like you have a lot of different personalities, and I never want to pull from just one specific individual. When I use these people, I'm focused on the story, and I've got a basic personality for the people in the story, but I like to pull different bits and pieces.
I think some of the stereotypes or archetypes at this point that exist for a reason though. So you've always got that professor character who's well-read and either is smart generally, but sometimes thinks he's smarter than he is or she. You've got the knife guy who has more knives than Carter has liver pills, and maybe or maybe not. Mm-hmm. He knows how to use them, but he sure has them. And you always know in a pinch, if he drops, I'm taking his knives because we might need them. You know what I mean? And then you got the – I call him the go to war or go to jail. But obviously, officially, you can't do that anymore. But, you know, stuff happens. Like I've seen I'll make this go away and we'll just lose the paperwork if you enlist and, you know, turn your life around. That stuff still happens today. I know of someone that it happened to in 2020. So, I mean, you know, we're not even talking distant past, but before it was that, it was like they enlisted to get away from their problems, right? Mm-hmm. Go as far away as the service would take them. So when you think about like you're writing about people you knew, it's almost like you're pulling the archetype that they fit. It sounds like.
Yeah, to a point, but then I like to do variations. So I never like to do, you know, one prime example is Private Stathis. All right. He is a very popular individual. I love this guy. He starts out as your quintessential screw up private. All right. He's like the guy that's like all throughout the series, everybody's saying, shut up, Stathis, because he makes the most stupid. Pardon?
He's your Carl. Shut up, Carl.
Yes, exactly. He's the Carl. But then he's not. And that's where I like to use those stereotypes, but then break away from them.
Away from them so much, or let the character evolve as the
I let the character evolve. But here's the thing. So Stathis is like the quintessential screw up private. Everybody's telling him to shut up. He's always making stupid comments and getting into trouble and stuff like that. And kind of my vision of the Marine Raiders is you have to essentially be in for at least 6 years before they accept you to Raider school, because they do a lot of training. It's like a year or two of training, just nonstop training, but they want to get their money's worth. So you have to reenlist. And Stathis, usually when you go to the Raiders, you have some time in the, and you'll be like a Lance Corporal or something like that. But Stathis gets to the Raider unit as a private, because he got busted down before he got sent. All right. So he's like the only private in this Raider platoon. And yeah, but as it goes on, as the story goes on, you find out a senior Lance Corporal, and he was tapped for corporal. But then he experience in squad leader school where he was, you know, I don't know if I want to be responsible for the lives of other people. You know, that's a lot of pressure. So then he went down this other path, and he, but let's just say that the coffee had an extra ingredient when he gave it. So at any rate, he got busted, and he didn't want to stay in the unit. He wanted to stay a private because he just didn't want that, you know, responsibility of being an NCO. And I've seen people like that. That I do know a guy that was like that. Awesome individual. He was in my unit, you know, in my squad at one point, and he was a screw up. He was a troublemaker. He was like, you know, he would come up for promotion, and everybody would say, "No, me, the platoon sergeant, the platoon commander," would say, "No, don't promote him. He's not. No, Let's stop that," because we'd put a check mark for people that are promotable and then people that weren't. So we'd say, "No, he's not NCO material. No, do not make him a corporal, period." All right. But we were doing a deployment and we forgot. And he got promoted to corporal. And he became the best damn corporal there was. You know, but we all thought he was like a total screw up, and it was just, but Stathis is kind of maybe in a way like him, in that he was pushed into a position of leadership and he ran with it. And the thing with Stathis is, you want to say, you know, he's a typical screw up private, lazy, but Stathis isn't lazy. He's a damn smart individual. So it's like in certain situations, you know, everybody's sitting around or something like that. You know, a private would be sleeping or, you know, playing his game or whatever. Stathis would be practicing magazine drills. Or, you know, he'd be practicing, you know, martial arts moves, you know, fighting in zero gravity or something like that. But as the series goes on, you slowly start to realize that Stathis is a badass. You know, he comes across as a stupid infantryman, but he's not. And then by the same token, you've got the gunnery sergeant. If you took Gunnery Sergeant Highway from Heartbreak Ridge and merged him with the physical appearance of The Rock, you would have Gunnery Sergeant Matheson. All right. Big guy, bald, you know, just a really tough guy. You don't want to mess with him. He talks a hard line. He's just, you know, he's there. But then even in book one, you realize that he has doubts and he has this problem, that nobody notices, and you don't realize until later. And I'll get to that in a minute. But when things are going bad and he's having doubts, his hand starts to shake. And what he does is he'll tuck it into his belt or, you know, brace it or something like that. So he might go around like this because, you know, he doesn't want anybody to see his shaking hands. And you'll see that all throughout the series. Now, one of the interesting things, and I cover it, but I don't think most readers see it until much later in the series, is that in one of the very first chapters, Stathis and Matheson are in a fighting position that's getting shelled. And they're in there. They're in powered armor. They've got a metal plate on top to keep shrapnel from coming down. But they're in there just waiting for a round to come through that metal plate and kill them. And they're in there with another Marine named, I think, Corporal Benson. And so they're in there shoulder to shoulder. The gunny had gotten trapped in that position as he's walking the lines. And they're talking, trying to ignore the death that's coming down on them, you know, and at that point, Matheson's hands start to shake. All right. He thinks nobody sees it because he tucks it under there. But what we don't realize until much later in the series is Stathis actually saw that. He saw that hand shaking and he realized that, okay, the gunny's a badass. He's a really tough guy. He puts on this show, but he cares. He's scared, but he can overcome it. And that starts to shape Stathis throughout the series. Because he knows at that point, then he can start looking at the gunnery sergeant and saying, okay, yeah, the gunny's near the edge. And then so it'll happen all throughout the series. And I don't know how many people really pick up on that consciously, because a lot of it, you know, the gunny would be in a bad situation and be like, okay, we're screwed. We got to do something. You know, he's trying to cycle things through. And Stathis says something stupid, all right? And that something stupid resets the gunnery sergeant's brain. It's like, shut up, Stathis. But then that takes the gunny out of his kind of misery, if you will. So it's, I think, a really good dynamic that most people aren't going to really see until they really, you know, start to evaluate things. But it's like the gunnery sergeant, you know, he's got his own personality. He is pretty competent, but he's getting older, you know, and then Stathis, you know, in the same situation. And that's where the series progresses and where it goes.
So let's back up to the series. So first off, obviously it's called The Last Marines. Where did the idea for this series come from? So we can introduce people because we're talking, you and I have talked about this series, so I know a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not everyone listening might. So let's start from the beginning. First off, where did you get the idea for the series The Last Marines?
So that kind of goes back to, I wanted to write to market. And then I said, heck with that. I was having too much fun. So I sat down and I figured, okay, well, what's out there? What do people like to see? And then plus I wanted to make a universe that I could expand on, that I could write out from different angles, that was very interesting and unique and had options. I wanted a lot of options in the series. So that's where I came up with The Last Marines. But then I was like, okay, well, let's take something I know, United States Marines, let's throw them into the future. All right. But I want them to have powered armor. I want them to have implanted artificial intelligences inside their brains. You know, so I had all these things I wanted in them and I wanted them to be aware of. And then, so I built that, but then I wanted them in the future. And it just kind of like rolled out. And went from there. So I started out with four Marines fighting some war on Papua New Guinea against a socialist union, I believe it was. And basically it was a raider platoon. Their job was just to go in there, you know, and they were going to be sent to Europa. There, you know, at that time, this is the late 21st century. We had a base on Europa around Jupiter. And then the Socialist Union, which is a collection of other countries, they were out there, and it's just a lot of fighting and bickering and stuff like that. You know how it goes. And so they were in that. They were being sent to Papua New Guinea, which was a kind of a, not a Cold War, but it was working up to a fight. And their goal was to just go in there as a platoon, as a raider platoon, before they go to Europa. Just get blooded, spend some time in a combat zone, you know, become a team. All right. Only for a short time. But while they're there, I forget what I call it, but it was basically the Tet Offensive. So they're there with a line battalion, you know, doing training and maybe some patrols or something like that when the Tet Offensive happens. And the Tet Offensive there in Papua New Guinea was, you had the rebels there in New Guinea, and they were reinforced by a major superpower. And then, just bad things happened. All right. So the Marines and the Army units that were there, they just got hit. It started to escalate into World War III at that point. So the company commander who had this platoon of Raiders, you know, they were Raiders, they were elite. So he wanted to use them like regular infantry platoon. And he did. He put them on the front. He said, okay, these are elite guys. Let's put them on the bleeding edge. And they suffered. They took casualties. All right, because they really were the spear tip. And they were defending a line, and they got hammered hard. But they had the advantage of the Scoobies, the sentient cybernetic biological interface, which is basically a computer, an AI that's part of them. It clones their brain cells, and it integrates that with the computer and memory and stuff like that. So it's really, you know, it's an implant, it's part of them, and it's very closely related. Excuse me. So they're there, they're in Papua New Guinea, and then they have some bad experiences. They do a patrol. The gunnery sergeant, you know, little history there. It was a four-man platoon or a four-man fire team. They got attacked. They were on part of the line. That's when they were getting shelled and stuff like that. Then they got attacked, and they took casualties. So one of the casualties was Stathis's team leader, the guy that was in the fighting position with him in the very beginning. And when you lose someone in combat, it's like everybody's kind of like, dude, you know, I like the guy. So there's an impact on that. And so that fire team was down four people. So the company commander is a real a-hole, and he sends them out on patrol. He says he wants a security patrol after this attack, and he picks the Raiders since they're supposed to be good at that. They go out there, they take a casualty, but while they're out there, they get orders from on high that says, okay, pull the Raider platoon out. We need to ship them to Europa. We have a window. So the gunnery sergeant's out there on patrol with three other Marines, and they have to get out. And then it didn't read. They get out, and they come back to Cape Canaveral. They're going to get on a shuttle, and that's where that part of the story ends. Excuse me. And it can be kind of disruptive, because I take the Marines that up until that point, they've been having a hard time. Then they go to Cape Canaveral. They get out processed. They see Diamond Winters, and she is the shuttle pilot at that point, and they just see her. They don't talk to her or anything like that. They've lost their lieutenant. They meet a guy named the commander of the Raider units is Major Beckett, and he plays in much further on. So they come in, and that's it. At Cape Canaveral, he gets a brand new lieutenant, doesn't know him for more than a few hours. He meets Major Beckett, and Major Beckett says, okay, when you get back, you know, we're going to have a talk. And then it stops, because technically, next they get on the ship, and they get sent off. During that time, when they get on the ship, they get put in stasis for the time that it takes to get to Europa. The ship gets attacked and destroyed. But the stasis pods are in different parts of the ship, so it's Stathis, the gunnery sergeant, Diamond Winters, and Sergeant Levin, who's Stathis' squad leader. Those are the only four survivors from that platoon and from that ship. And they're in stasis. Their stasis pod part of the ship goes flying off to deep space where they're not found for like 400 years. So it's a Buck Rogers moment at that point. All right. Then, you know, you step back and you have Scotty. Now, I mentioned Scotty is a member of the Iroquois Chukot. She is Republic Special Forces. It's one of her jobs to go in there and train locals. That's what she does. She's opposed to the SOG. And during this 400 years, social organizational governance has taken over. All right. And they're very boot hill, you know, thuggish. And, you know, they make the Nazis look like good guys. All right. Very, very mean people. And so SOG is taking control of everything. And the Vapal Republic is a group of ships. Think like Battlestar Galactica in a way. Their homeworld was destroyed by the governance, by the social organizational governance, and they fled aboard ships. And they've got home stars, which are big, massive, hollowed out asteroids that can go into faster than light. Then you've got your battle stars, which are just big, massive, super dreadnoughts, and then other ships. And they fled on those. So they're lurking in deep space, trying to fight back against the governance. And that's the Power Republic. Now, one of the things with them is their homeworld was a lot of Finnish, German, Swedish. A lot of these cultures went to this homeworld called Midgard. All right. And Sog destroyed Midgard. So when they left, they were more peaceful, but they wanted to get back to their warrior roots. They wanted to, you know, a lot of time had passed. So they kind of, you know, we lost a lot of our warrior culture. Let's bring that back. So they bring that back in a combination of, you know, they end up like Vikings, but not with the horn helmets, but Viking mentality. And you've got the Iser, which are infantry. You've got the Vanir, which are Space Force. All right. And it's a republic. So the Iser, within the Iser, you've got three groups. You've got the Erquist, which are like Army Special Forces. You've got the Jaegers, which are the Rangers. And then you got the regular Iser, which are regular troops. All right. Scotty is the Erquist, which is Special Forces. And she's on a planet. And the story picks up again after the gunnery sergeant. They're in deep space, about to get picked up by the SOG. But that picks up with Scotty. And she's on a planet fighting the SOG, but they're losing the battle. And she and her team of specialists, they just basically have to escape that planet. It, you know, there's a lot more to it, but they escape the planet and then they go back to the home stars, and the home star says they find out that there's a psychic, and I really like this girl. I didn't expect for her to be such a big, significant part of things, but I just had so much fun with it. And there's this, the Power Republic has a bunch of psychics that run things. They're not usually mind controllers, but one of the psychics are starting to pick up on something. Something's going to happen in the universe, and it's really starting to scare them, and they don't know what. And they believe that something is going to happen at a special research station near Seoul. All right. Now, at about this time, that special research station that they're kind of thinking about or hearing about, that finds the four U.S. Marines in stasis. And it brings them out, and it at the station, what they're doing is they're trying to research FTL communications, because the governance is growing large. Now, it gets more interesting in that space travel is done through wormholes. So if you're going to travel from point A to point B, you open a wormhole and you kind of like drop in, and the deeper you go, the further you can go in real space. All right. And then when you come back out, you know, you've traveled the distance. Now, nobody really knows what shore space is or what it's about or anything like that. It's just one of those, you know, think of it like the ocean during the wooden ships. We knew it was on the surface, but we didn't know what was underneath it. And that's what it is like with shore space. They understand the mechanics and stuff like that, so they can dip in and out. So at any rate, back to, you know, you've got the Power Republic. They're going to send an expedition to find out what's going on. That expedition is led by Scotty and her special forces team, but they have an attachment of Sif. Now, Sif looks like a 12-year-old girl. She's not. She's like almost 200 years old because the Republic has longevity treatment. But she is, you know, she's a certified badass because she looks like she's 12. She's not. She has something called Kallman syndrome. And it just basically keeps you from going beyond puberty. But that gives her an edge, and she's a special agent and a lot of stuff there. But she is psychic. And we don't learn how psychic until much later. And her original goal was just to keep the Iser from killing the Marines on the station. But she evolved well beyond that. So what happens is the Marines are on the station, and they're starting to realize what's going on. That, you know, the United States is gone. That they're prisoners, that this governance is a really bunch of nasty people, and the governance is going to bring them back to Earth and kill them. All right. It's like, okay, we don't need these rejects. We're just going to bring them back, execute them and stuff like that. So they need to find an escape. Now, at this research, like I said, they were studying faster than light, or they were trying to study faster than light communication. They thought they had found the secret in an alien box on a distant world. So they thought this box is a communicator. Now, back to shore space. And I'm sorry if this is, there's a lot of convoluted stuff here. So shore space is a parallel dimension. All right. Throughout our history as humans, we have ghosts, we've had dragons, we've had, you know, all, vampires, all these different things we've had, but we don't have any scientific proof they exist. All right. Furthermore, out in the galaxy, where is everybody? We've got the Fermi paradox. Everybody's gone, you know. We'd expect more aliens and stuff like that, but there's nobody there. So here's where it starts to get interesting, is that our dimensions start to brush up against other dimensions. When that happens, dimensional energies can flow across, and that's where you get ghosts that manifest. You might have dragons and other things from these other dimensions that slide in. And then throughout our history, we've had that. So we've had these little brushes, but now it's starting to come together. And when it comes together too much, a lot of these really nasty entities from these other dimensions come into our dimension and wipe out civilizations. And that's what's about to happen. And that box is a blocker that keeps some of these bad entities from entering our dimension. And then you don't realize that until, you know, books maybe 3 or 4. But the Marines are on that station. When they open up that box, or when they trigger that box, a demon comes through. And then just all sorts of nasty stuff happens on the station. So think Doom. At that point, they have to escape, and in the process of escaping, they encounter the Isher, Scotty, and a special ops team that are trying to figure out what's going on. And then book one basically ends with them all leaving the station together to figure out, you know, okay, well, what just happened there? And then we slide into book two.
So what would you say the age range for this series is?
I would say 16 and up. You could probably go younger than that. There's no extreme violence. There's no sex or anything like that. I try to keep it relatively PG-13, but relatively. I do find, based on metrics and ads and stuff like that, most of the people that like the books are older veterans, you know, or older people. You know, because they, I think, can really associate with a lot of what's going on there. And I grew up on Battlestar Galactica, Buck Rogers, Babylon 5, Doom, and a lot of these other things. So I kind of incorporate some of that into my books. And you'll see bits and pieces here and there of those. So I think it resonates with the older groups. But by the same token, there's nothing... I guarantee there's nothing that's you're not going to find in most video games. The weaponry is it can be pretty nasty. One of the things they use is plasma, or not plasma weapons, but blazers, which basically is a plasma capsule. When it goes into the chamber, it charges it, and that causes an explosion. That explosion superheats the plasma and sends it out. So when it hits, you've got this extremely hot bit of plasma that hits, and when you have something, you know, it's just basically explosive when it hits human flesh, but it's also capable of slicing through most metals. So describing someone that gets hit when they're not in armor is kind of a mess and kind of gory. So that might be as far as it goes as far as age range, but there's no gratuitous sex, little swearing, but not that much. I don't make a habit of swearing.
Okay. Is this the only series you've written so far? Because I know 10 books is a lot, but...
Yeah, no, 10 books. I've written another series called the Conglomerate Series, and there was a review on that one that I really love. It's like, for a Marine, how was it phrased? It's like, pretty clean for a Marine, or something like that, that, you know, I, the... person who wrote the review was just surprised that there wasn't that much cursing and swearing and gratuitous sex and stuff like that. And, but that was the Conglomerate series. And that was like one of my first published military sci-fi series. I want to say back in 2011. And it was hard to market and it didn't do well until people started reading my military, my Gods of War series, my Last Marines. But it was a nice series about a Marine who went to space and lost his wife and found her again. And it's, I'd say, kind of a feel-good story, but there are bad parts.
Okay.
And then...
So this cover that we've got for Gods of War, which is the first book in the Last Marine series, is that the power armor as you envision it? I know you did the cover, right?
No, I did not do the cover.
Oh, I thought you did.
The cover? Uh-uh. No. So that was Joseph Caleb of Caleb Designs that did that cover. And that's mostly a cover. But the armor is kind of pretty close, because the way I envision powered armor is it's like a wetsuit with a nanotechnology on the skin of the wetsuit. But then over that, you can put larger plates, and I call them trauma plates. So you've got shoulder plates, you've got, you know, breastplate and things like that to give you additional protection. But the basic suit is almost like a wetsuit. And then the helmet is, you know, it's going to be a helmet regardless either way. But that helmet was pretty good, and I actually know where it comes from. He did a much better job than I could have, but some of that was Daz 3D, and that helmet is awesome, and it slides back so you can see the eyes, but it keeps the face hidden. So I was actually able to go through, you know, after I saw the cover, I found the way he did it, and I've been able to recreate it and some other things, and I have like the gunnery sergeant with the helmet off and stuff like that, and it looks just like that, but not. And Caleb Designs did an outstanding, they do all the covers. Excellent job. Very, very well done. Kudos to Caleb Design.
This is one that you have for one of the series, your free short story.
Yeah. So I did that cover. That's a cover that I did.
Yeah.
And then, yep. And I did that one. But that was definitely Caleb.
Go ahead.
That was definitely Joseph Caleb, or Caleb Design, that did it.
Cool. So you've got the series. They're sort of stuck into the future. You've got 10 books out as of the day we're recording, because we're recording it on the Ides of March. We thought it was sort of a fortuitous day to record a story about the Last Marines. Do you see that series to keep going? Do you have like an end in mind?
I have to write more stories because of the way 10 ends. So when I write, I do it by arcs. So books 1 through 6 is one arc, and it's the Van Hat, which are the alien, the demons, the incorporates a lot of these nasties from history. Now books 7 to 10, you know, when I originally wrote 1 to 6, you know, then the publisher said, okay, now it's time to do the next ones. And I'm like, okay. So I did the next series and started adding to that. So I did the next one, which is the AI Collective. So one of the things in book one is the AIs, after the Marines left and before SOG took power, there was an AI war. The AIs basically destroyed the United States. All right. And then the governance and everybody thought the AIs were gone, but they weren't. And we learned that in book 7, that the AIs did not lose the war. They just wanted people to think that. And then so book 7 to 10 is another arc that I call the AI Collective. And it involves the AI, and it involves the Van Hat from the first 6. And it's a complete separate arc. So where 10 ends, 10 ends in a very interesting place, because at the start of book 7, I actually tell you how that arc is going to end and where we're going to be at book 10. The very first chapter, Stathis is doing a recording because he's getting ready to leave Earth. And in book 10 at the very end, he's taking that recording and he's giving it to Scotty, essentially. And then books 11 and on, I have to write just because of all the things that happen in book 10. Book 10 kind of like ends a lot of arcs. And the way I write is a lot of different people get involved. So, for instance, in the first six books, you had the four Marines. You had Scotty, her team. You had Sif. And you have all these different characters, and they all have their different arcs. And the arcs work through all the different books. And then everything collides at the end. So book six is a very intense book where it's like people don't know what's going to happen. But then you start to realize things from book one are impacting things in book six. So there's a lot of tied in pieces. All right. If you haven't gotten to book six, spoiler alert, Major Beckett is not dead. And he ends up in book six, and he's very central to everything in book six. And in book one, Levine, Sergeant Levine, he has a K-bar, and you'll see references to the K-bar all throughout the six books. But it really becomes central in book six when he's ramming it into the skull of a demon. So it's like...
As one does.
Yes. So it's like all these different pieces come together in the end of the arc. And that's how it is with book 7 through 10, is that's another arc. Everything comes together. So all the players, you know, I call them players or characters, they all end up in a certain place, the ones that survive at any rate, because not all of them do. And then I've got things kind of like most of the loose ends tied up, you know, so I can continue with the next arc relatively fresh. So it's, and there's, you know, one example, and kind of, I don't want to spoil it if anybody's read things, but it's interesting because you, a character shows up, and I want to say book four, he's a mystery character, and you don't figure out, cause he's going through things. He knows things that nobody else should know. He knows that the gunnery sergeant and Scotty are going to be going by a certain space station at a certain time. They're going to request certain things, and then they're going to go off and they're going to do something. He knows that before they actually arrive. And he has bits and pieces throughout, and he shows up at a critical junction in book six to help Winters inspire the other people and go and save the gunny, because he knows that the gunny is going to die if the gunny's not dead already. And he knows a lot of things are coming in, but you don't really find out who he is until the very end. But then you also find out, and it's not General Beckett. You also find out that this mystery character has actually been there since maybe the first or second chapter. So it's, you know, there are a lot of pieces that come together and a lot of, you know, interesting things. And the same, I do the same thing with the next series with Beckett. You know, it starts out, you think, you know, he's a really evil dude, but then you start to realize that even dating back to book six, he wasn't evil. There was something else going on. And then by book 10, you're just like, you're kind of rooting for the guy, I hope. But it's interesting stuff.
Do you have a favorite character?
It's a toss up between Stathis and the gunny.
Okay.
So Stathis is, you know, like I said, he's you'll see him, and I bust on him a lot. But he's a really funny guy. He's a great guy.
So if you use gunny from Highway from Heartbreak Ridge, did you use the famous line, "I was a commanding officer of my Marine Corps ROTC detachment"?
No, I didn't use that one, but there's plenty of other ones. There's one point in, I want to say book 7 or 8, where the gunny is actually promoting Stathis to lieutenant. All right, spoiler alert. And then he wants Stathis to get out of his office So he gives Stathis a map and compass. So a veteran, most people are like, huh?
He's told Stathis is
the second lieutenant. Yeah, he just told, he tells Stathis to get lost. You know, here's your map and compass, lieutenant. Get. So it's like, you know, veterans are going to pick up on that pretty quick. And I put it in there. I explained it. But it's like, you know, you're not going to see that in most books. You know, only veterans are going to put something like that in there. But that's how they start to interact at that point. You know, and it's just a lot of fun. And I had a lot of fun with the wedding. There's a wedding in book 9. I'm not going to say who. Or no, it's a book 10. I'm not going to say who. And then
is Stathis Murray's pillow a full weeb?
I'm not saying, but it's announced the wedding. The Marine proposes to somebody in the middle of a firefight. Okay, and how it works out is, you know, I like this part because, you know, they're in a firefight, very intense on the moon, and you know they're getting shot, and then she goes down, and the Marine's like, you know, oh my God, you know, because he likes her and she's, you know, important to him, so he goes running over there and he's kneeling down, you know, and then the enemy attacks, so he takes a grenade and he takes it and he chucks it, all right, but he still has the grenade ring in his hand, but she gets up and she says, you know, what's your problem? If you're kneeling, you know, you better, I forget what she says, but he says, you know, he's thinking, it's like, well, what do I do? And, you know, it's a dumb thing, and you've seen it in the military. It's like, well, will you marry me? And he hands her this grenade ring, you know, and that's how he ends up proposing to her. And then he realizes who he's talking to. And there's other factors involved, and it's like, I shouldn't have been screwing around and said that, but now I'm committed. So she takes a grenade ring and says, yes, I'll marry you. And then it goes on from there.
Nice.
But it's like, it's an interesting little piece.
Would you live in this world? I had fun with it. Would you live in this world?
It was very dark.
So probably not.
Yeah, probably not. There's a lot of bad things that happen. It'd be interesting, but then that's a curse. May you live in interesting times.
Absolutely.
These are interesting times.
Is it close to Warhammer 40K levels of dark?
Not quite that. There is some influence from Warhammer 40K. But I don't, it could, yeah, it could be to a point. You know, things just keep getting worse. You know, at the end of book 10, things are down to the wire. Humanity is basically retreated to two places, Earth and Jupiter. All right. They've lost control of the moon. They've lost the capital of the governance where Matheson was in control was the moon. But they lose control of that and they have to return to Earth, which is a radioactive wasteland. So things are very, very dark at the end of book 10. And they're not so dark at the end of book 6, but there's room for improvement in 6. Because 6 ends with them saving the Sol system from a Vanhat invasion. And he's like, yay, we won, we saved Sol. But then as book 7 picks up in the next series, it's like, mostly they saved it. But there's still a lot of cleanup. There's still a lot of problems. And, you know, things just... And then you introduce the AI, which have decided that humans are a liability and need to be wiped out.
Including the ones in their heads?
Yes. Oh, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. So the AI collective is one of the things with the Vanhat, with the aliens, the demons from the other dimension, is they take over and manipulate organic beings. All right. So with their energy, they could turn you into a werewolf, a vampire, you know, other things like that. They just do different things. Different demons have different abilities. So throughout the series, the Marines are fighting trolls. They're fighting vampires. They're fighting kind of zombies at one point. And then in book six, they end up fighting a dragon. So if you look at the cover for book six, you've got a Marine there, you know, holding a dragon, you know, at bay. That doesn't really happen in the book, but the concept is there. You know, there is a dragon, and Stathis has a great line with that one, but there's a dragon in book six. So it's like very interesting in that regard. But then the aliens, the AI collective, because the Van Hat infect basically organic beings, the collective believes that they're immune to the Van Hat, that the Van Hat will ignore them. And they figure, well, if the humans are all wiped out, then the Van Hat will leave and we don't have to deal with them and they won't be a danger to us. So you've got the humanity and you've got, or you've got the Van Hat and you've got the AI collective. They both want to wipe out humanity basically for different reasons. And that's the AI collective has made that decision in the second series and they're starting to come after mankind. They're not friends with the Van Hat, but they're not exactly enemies. And at one point, you know, the Marines are fighting Van Hat on the left, AI collective on the right, and they're both coming for him. And the Scoobies, that the implanted intelligences, they're also part organic. So they are a threat because they can be infected by the Van Hat, according to the collective.
Okay.
So it's gets to be a mess.
So was there anything we didn't cover that you think the audience needs to know before we wrap this up? Because I realize we've been going for about an hour and a half, and I promised you an hour.
Yeah. I'm working on books 11 to 14 now. So it's not the end of the series. It's not the end. I've got some ideas. Operation Seraphim is coming. And basically, what that's about is if you follow the arc to 10, the Marines have discovered that there's another alien race out there that at one time in the past has defeated and pushed back the Van Hat. So they are preparing an expedition to go find these, and I call them angels. They're going to go find these angels to get their help. The collective does not think this is a good idea. And the Van Hat don't think this is a good idea. So they're going to have a very rough time. And not all the Marines are available to go on this expedition. And I'll just leave that as is.
Okay.
I can't leave it at book 10. I've got to at least complete the arc. As a personal matter, I like happy stories. So I'm challenged in that. The only way I could probably end this permanently is to kill everybody off. But I want to end it on a positive note. And number 10 is not exactly that note.
Okay.
So more is coming.
So this is the part of the interview, dear listener, where I remind you to please be kind and speak your mind on the reviewing platforms. Your reviews help the right readers find the right book, so please do your part. And William would love all the reviews. Throw all the 5 stars at him. He promises he'll catch every single one. And if he gets his 1,000th review, I understand that he's going to get a Martian and he's going to cook them for steak, and we'll get to find out what they taste like. Yeah. True story. So, how do you take your steak? That's a good way to end it on a happy note.
Medium rare, almost raw.
So bleeding on the way out to you.
Yes.
So that's where the darkness comes from. Okay. One of these days, I'm going to get someone to tell me about their near steak, soy burger thing, whatever the fake steak is.
No, I'll never touch that. You can have it. I like my steak.
You see all the pictures, right, when the hurricanes or whatever are happening, and it's the only thing left in the grocery store.
Yeah, I wouldn't eat that stuff.
All right. And how could listeners find you?
Well, I've got a website, williamsfrisbee.com. Usually I'm on Facebook. You can just Google William S. Frisbee. But usually I spend more time on Facebook. That's the easiest way to find me. And that's Facebook.com/William S. Frisbee.
Okay, and we will link to all that in the show notes. So if you're lazy, you can just click and follow the link. Make it easy for you. You can find us on our Linktree at linktr.ee, linktr.ee/Blasters and Blades Podcast. Again, linktr.ee/Blasters and Blades Podcast, where we link to all the things, the bit shoots, the rumbles, the YouTubes, the Twitters, the email, blastersandbladespodcast@gmail.com. We have our Facebook group and Facebook page, and Madam Stabby Stab's Instagram, Twitter, and email. Sometimes she even beats it to it and shares her own memes before I steal them from her. We have our website at anchor.fm/blasters-and-blades. Again, anchor.fm/blasters-and-blades, where for as little as 99 cents a month, you can help keep the lights on. Every penny helps, and we're grateful for your contribution. We could support the show more directly at buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Handley. Again, buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Handley. Be sure to put in the comment section that it's for the podcast, and I promise I will keep my co-hosts duly caffeinated. They will drink some of that coffee brand coffee Java until it pours out of their toenails because, you know, their eyes are tired at this point. And with that being said, you can get that 10% discount at Coffee Brand Coffee using the code PODCASTGRUNTS. With that said, thank you for spending some of your precious time with us. For my absentee co-host, I am J.R. Handley, and this was the Blasters and Blades Podcast. We'll be back next week at the same time, where we'll indulge our love of nerd culture, cheesy jokes, and all things that go boom. Thanks for coming on, William.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
This was fun. We'll have to have you back for more, you know, nerd out podcasts, because you were on the, what was it, the Big Stompy the Max episode. Yep. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. So we'll have to find more topics to get you out. You can get all nerdy awesome. With us. All right. Have a nice one. And then with